Welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 527 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. In today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK and Step 3 exams. This is going to be series 113. Let's jump right into it. So what if they give you a question about an African-American female and they tell you that this lady has, over the last 3 months, stopped going to the beach because whenever she goes, she has this rash that breaks out on her skin, especially on her face. And then you're giving some labs and you notice that her ESR and CRP are markedly elevated. And you notice that her hematocrit is decreased and her white blood cell count is decreased. What should you be thinking about? I would hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this is lupus. I know some of you may be like, wait, what? Lupus? Yeah, that's precisely what this person has. And again, I think, as I've said so many times on this podcast, the USMLEs, their stock in trade these days is same concepts, different descriptions. That's the way to see if you're a memorizer or you're a person that really understands what's going on. So let's ask ourselves, so why is this lupus? Well, first, it's a female, African-American female. And then you see this element of the sun bothering this person. That's photosensitivity. Again, our friends at the NBMEs, they're not going to always come out and say Miller rash, Miller rash, Miller rash. Again, if they see Miller rash, everyone will get a 270. Well, obviously, that does not happen, right? So again, they are very big on descriptions, right? So, you know, they can just say photosensitivity, or they can say the person has a rash that worsens with sun exposure, right? You see all those things, think about lupus. And you may also wonder, Divine, where did the low hematocrit and the low white blood cell count come from? Again, it's from an autoimmune cytopenia, right? So the thing is, people that have lupus, they have this nasty habit of making autoantibodies against their blood elements. They basically make autoantibodies against blood elements, right? So white blood cells, red blood cells, platelets, right? I mean, obviously, if you make autoantibodies against your white blood cells, that's an autoimmune leukopenia. If you make autoantibodies against your red blood cells, that's going to be an autoimmune hemolytic anemia. That's going to be Coombs positive. That's a nice way to kind of think about that. Remember, whenever you have Coombs positivity, it means that you have hemolytic anemia from an immune-based origin, like antibodies are messing up your cells. And then these people also tend to have an autoimmune thrombocytopenia. That's going to be ITP, immune thrombocytopenia. Many times you make autoantibodies against GP2B3A. So those are some key components of those autoimmune cytopenias. Again, you can mention immune thrombocytopenia on your exam and satisfy everyone that has memorized stuff. Or you can see an autoimmune thrombocytopenia. People be like, wait, what? Or they can just put anti-GP2B3A antibodies as an answer instead of putting immune thrombocytopenia. Again, these are the ways you need to be thinking about your exams. So, again, what are a few high-yield things to know about lupus? Again, I'll say critical things you want to know about lupus for exam, because honestly, I could probably even make a lupus podcast if I've not made one already. But there are so many things to know about lupus for the exams. There are so many ways they can go after it. Lupus is like the prototypical let me backtrack here. Whenever you see, Divine mentioning multi-systems processes and disorders, or the USMLE is mentioning multi-systems processes and disorders, lupus is the classic example of something like that, right? So what are the key things to know about lupus for exam? Number one, their symptoms are very periodic. They don't usually have constant symptoms. They'll have chronic symptoms, but they're periodic. There's a periodicity to their symptoms. Number two, lupus is way more common in women on the USMLEs. Can you get a male having lupus question on your exam? Absolutely. But who is it going to be like 90% of the time? It's going to be females. What race typically gets lupus on the USMLEs? African Americans, right? Especially African American women. Again, it's usually rare for them to give lupus to a Caucasian on the exam, right? So this extra bit of information, you'd be surprised at how it can help you very rapidly get rid of certain answers on your test. And then, what's the pathophase behind lupus? Honestly, if you really think about it, because there's a reason why you learn, anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies, anti-Smith antibodies, ANA, blah, 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 blah. Basically, it's from immune complex deposition. Many of these diseases, right, you have this immune complex deposition, you have an antigen and an antibody. I just like to think of it this way. You know some people that just always seem to carry trouble with them. Wherever they go, they carry issues with them. And actually, I'm going to make a life lesson on that at the end of this. But I'm going to discuss a quick life lesson at the end of this podcast on just that concept. But there are some people that just seem to carry trouble anywhere they go. They're like partners in crime. They show up somewhere. If there was peace, chaos breaks out. That's literally what you see with lupus, right? You basically form these antigen antibody complexes, and then they just go to different places in the body. They can go to your joints, they can cause joint disease, they can go to your skin, they can cause skin disease, they can go to your kidneys, they can cause kidney disease, right? Lupus nephritis. They can go to the person's pleural surface, they can cause like pleuritis, they can cause pleurisy, they can cause many, many different problems, right? So again, it's from immune complex deposition. That's the big pathophase you want to know, right? And again, you're used to the Mailer rash. Again, they're not going to use the term Mailer rash on your exams. They're going to, if they do, that's the NBME giving you a freebie. They're going to describe it. They're going to basically discuss a rash around the nasal, you know, around the nose, around the cheeks, things like that, right? Think of that. Sometimes you may see the term discoid rash. Kind of looks circular in a sense, right? And what if they give you a question about a person that has lupus? And they tell you that, oh, this person, I don't know, this kind of turned into a semi-lupus podcast. But anyhow, they give you a question and they tell you, basically, I want you to get every lupus question right after this vignette. So they tell you that, oh, this person that has lupus has been having shortness of breath and she has pain with deep breaths or whatever. And they tell you that you have like somewhat decreased breath sounds on that same side. You want to think about serositis, right? Serositis. Lupus likes to go after like serosal surfaces, right? It can go, the classic one on the exam you'll go after is your pleural surface. So it can cause a pleuritis. It's going to hurt as you breathe. Those people, they don't like taking deep breaths because whenever they take that deep breath, they kind of feel this almost like a splint, like someone is like injecting something to their pleural cavity. That's going to hurt. And many times those people will have a concomitant pleural effusion. Right? Or they tell you that a person has lupus and man, their creatinine is rising and whatnot. You obviously want to think about lupus nephritis. You want to think about lupus nephritis. Usually for that, you're going to go ahead and get a renal biopsy of some sort, right? And again, don't forget photosensitivity with lupus. Photosensitivity. Right? And remember, most people that have lupus, they're ANA positive. ANA is very sensitive for lupus. Okay? ANA is very, 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 very sensitive for lupus, right? So it has a very high negative predictive value for lupus. You probably noticed this in recent times. I've been trying to bring some biostats integrations with some of the concepts I discuss because that's how they do it these days. Biostats is not about memorizing the formulas. It's about like, oh, wait, how can they present this, right? Like they can give you a lupus question, ANA positivity, or they can give you a lupus question, give you a bunch of labs, and then they ask, which of the following has the highest negative predictive value for diagnosing lupus? I hope you're going to go ahead and pick ANA. ANA is very, very sensitive for lupus, right? If something is sensitive, it means it has a high negative predictive value, right? How about specificity? Let's look at things from the other end of the coin. Well, things like anti-double-stranded DNA and anti-Smith antibodies, those are very, very specific for lupus. When you see those, there's not many other things that cause those things, right? So make sure you understand the difference between sensitivity and specificity. Almost everyone that has lupus will have a positive ANA, but there are many things that can cause a positive ANA. So ANA is sensitive for lupus, but it's not specific for lupus. It's one of these things that people, you'd be surprised by how far people go and they don't have a true understanding of what sensitivity and specificity means, right? So I'm going to repeat that statement again. Make sure you kind of think about it. Almost everyone that has lupus will have a positive ANA, but there are many causes of a positive ANA that are not lupus. There are many causes of a positive ANA that are not lupus. That's very important to keep at the back of your mind for exams. So ANA is sensitive for lupus, has a high negative predictive value for lupus, but is not specific for lupus. But if we're thinking, I don't know why this is kind of beaming in my mind that Divine discussed this concept. It will help someone on their exams. But anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies, anti-Smith antibodies, they're very, very specific for lupus. They're very, very specific for lupus. So they have a high positive predictive value, right? So anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies, anti-Smith antibodies, you don't find them in many other conditions besides lupus. So they're pretty specific. They have a very high positive predictive value for lupus. And also remember, if they give you a question about a lupus patient that has a lot of venous thromboembolic disease or they've lost many pregnancies, like, you know, spontaneous abortions, think of antiphospholipid syndrome. Think of antiphospholipid syndrome. Remember, people that have antiphospholipid syndrome, typically they're going to have venous thromboembolic disease. You're going to see these people having all these issues, PEs, DVTs, strokes, and they tend to lose pregnancies on a somewhat recurring basis. Remember, those people, they're one of those folks where a mixing study would not correct the PTT, right? So remember, it's kind of weird. Antiphospholipid syndrome, these people have a high PTT, right? Many times you think that, oh, gee, if I have a high PTT, you know, I should not have, I should not be hypercoagulable. But an antiphospholipid syndrome, probably something I can discuss, although I've probably discussed it actually in a previous podcast, like gone deep into pathophase. But you have a high PTT, but they're hypercoagulable. And one of the things they love with these antiphospholipid syndrome is to test the mixing study. And typically, the mixing study is where you take normal serum that contains clotting factors and put it, mix it with the serum of a person that has high PTT and see, okay, will the PTT normalize? Well, the thing is, in a disease like hemophilia, where you have a factor 8 or factor 9 deficiency, that's hemophilia A or B respectively, if you mix in normal serum, you're pretty much giving them the clotting factors they're deficient in, then obviously the PTT is going to normalize because you're pretty much giving them what they're missing. But in a person that has antiphospholipid syndrome, a mixing study will not correct the PTT elevation. Why? Because antiphospholipid syndrome, those people, they have a clotting, it's a clotting factor inhibitor disorder. They pretty much make autoantibodies against their clotting factors. So you're like, oh, okay, this person's PTT is elevated. But the thing is, if you were to do a mixing study and give normal serum that contains clotting factors, those autoantibodies that are the pathophase behind antiphospholipid syndrome will gobble up those clotting factors, so the PTT will not correct. That's actually one of those nice ways that they test antiphospholipid syndrome on your exams. They'll give you a question about a person that has a high PTT that does not correct with a mixing study. Slam dunk, that's antiphospholipid syndrome. Although, believe it or not, you can also find that same those same labs in hemophilia if they've developed autoantibodies against factor 8 or factor 9. That's actually something that over time happens in people that have hemophilia. Because obviously, if you have hemophilia and you're lacking clotting factors, we give you those clotting factors back, right? We can give, you know, recombinant clotting factors, and or you can even get transfusions of some stuff that contains the clotting factors. The only problem is that over time, because those proteins are not native to your body, your immune system will start making autoantibodies against those things. That's why people that have hemophilia, after a while, or at least some people, they stop being responsive to infusions of like factor 8 or factor 9 concentrate because they develop autoantibodies. So how do you know that a person that has hemophilia has developed autoantibodies against their clotting factors? Simple, just do a mixing study and you'll notice that that PTT that previously corrected with a mixing study will no longer correct because those autoantibodies have come into view. That's almost like it's almost like they're tending towards antiphospholipid syndrome in a sense. Different disease, but somewhat similar pathophysiology. Okay, let's continue. Spent way too much time on that. Okay, so what are some other things you'll find in lupus? Well, again, remember I said with the autoimmune hemolytic anemia, the Coombs test is going to be positive. It's going to be the direct Coombs test that's going to be positive. Many people stress out about like, oh, Divine, I got to know direct Coombs, indirect Coombs. Honestly, I don't really care about knowing the difference because I know that in generally my experience on the USMLEs, there's generally one call, there's only one thing that they almost ever use the indirect Coombs test for. What do they use it for? It's for the RH incompatibility, to figure out a woman's antibody status, to see if she has formed anti-RH antibodies or not. That's it. Most other cases of Coombs anything on the USMLEs, like autoimmune hemolytic anemia, or what else do they use this stuff for? So autoimmune hemolytic anemia, or, you know, I guess that's the only big thing that comes to mind. But yeah, I will say most cases of Coombs testing. Oh, another one can be a transfusion reaction. Exactly, that's the other thing I was thinking about. Like an acute hemolytic transfusion reaction. They also do the direct Coombs test in that circumstance, right? But indirect Coombs is usually going to be RH incompatibility country. Pretty much every other thing is usually going to be direct Coombs. That's just a nice way I kind of pass all things out on my exams, right? And again, remember, one kind of weird, bizarre, strange question that they can give you on your exams is they can give you a question about a person going through a lupus flare, and then they'll make a table out of it. They'll say which of the following will be found on further analysis of this patient's serum, and then they'll put a table that has two rows. One row is going to talk about antibody titers, another row is going to talk about complement levels. One row will talk about antibody titers, another row will talk about complement levels. what's going to be true of the, and they'll put increase, decrease, decrease, decrease. You know, they'll put all the different permutations. Well, what should you know here? When people are going through a lupus flare, their antibody titers are going to go up. That's super high yield to know for exams, right? So all these things like the anti-Smith antibodies, the anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies, those titers will rise with a lupus flare. But what's going to happen to their complement levels? Their complement levels are going to go down, right? So they're going to have low levels of C3, low levels of C4. One of the weird things they do is kind of like a throwback from step one, is CH50. CH50 is just like an unorthodox measurement of how your complement levels are, right? It's going to be decreased. You're going to have decreased CH50, okay? So kind of keep that at the back of your mind. Now, you may wonder, Divine, okay, the antibody titers make sense, you know, more inflammation, whatever, but why do the complement levels go down? Well, here's the thing. Those antigen-antibody complexes, one thing you kind of want to keep at the back of your mind with those is that they actually trigger or activate complement. If you trigger and activate complement, they're going to be using up your complement proteins. That's something that's super, super high yield to know for your exams. Okay, so again, just to summarize, make sure you know this. You're going to see an increase during a lupus flare. You're going to see an increase in their antibody titers and a decrease in their complement levels. Okay, now, what's another thing they love to test? This is actually something that really pops up, but when it pops up, pretty much everybody gets this stuff wrong, right? So I would hope you're not one of those people. What is this thing I'm talking about? Is they will ask, what arm of the immune system is all messed up in a person that has lupus? Well, you want to think about aberrant innate immune activation. Aberrant innate immune activation is going to be a problem with your innate immune system, not your adaptive immune system. Please keep that in mind. I know you may be like, Divine, antibodies against this and that and this and that, but again, on your exams, I'm not going to go into the details of it. This is a rapid review series, but I would strongly encourage you to think about problems with the innate immune system. Okay, problems with the innate immune system, that's very, very high yield to know for your exams, right? But again, if they give you a question about, again, any of these problems like lupus nephritis or arthritis and lupus or whatever, again, always think about immune complex deposition. That's the pathophase behind those symptoms. Those immune complexes, they deposit in those different areas of the body, and then they cause problems, right? And remember, we're going to manage lupus with hydroxychloroquine, right? Obviously, if you have a flare, we're going to give you steroids. All right. And don't forget, every now and then, they can actually throw a question on your exams, believe it or not, where they'll give you a lupus patient, the person has anti-Ro and anti-La antibodies. Remember, it's not only Sjogren's that has anti-Ro and anti-La. Lupus is also associated with positive anti-Ro and anti-La antibodies. Remember, anti-Ro, those are the anti-SSA antibodies. Anti-La, those are the anti-SSB antibodies. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about like a 63-year-old male, and they tell you that, you know, for the past 6 months, he has been having pain in both knees, but that it's worse in the right knee, and that he has a little bit of stiffness in the morning. What should you be thinking about? I hope you're saying, Divine, this is osteoarthritis. I know, right? I throw in that stiffness. I'm sure some of you see stiffness, you're like, ooh, Divine, rheumatoid arthritis. No, come on, that's not smart, right? A 63-year-old, you're not going to wait till age 63 to start getting rheumatoid arthritis. That doesn't make any sense, right? So this person has osteoarthritis. And remember, osteoarthritis, what other term could he use for it on the exam? Why put osteoarthritis as an answer when you can put something like non-inflammatory arthritis as an answer, right? Again, I'm telling you this, you may not believe me, but when you take your real exam, you'll come back and say, Divine was right on this thing. I kid you not, the USMLEs, they don't give straight answers anymore. They give derivative answers. Instead of saying osteoarthritis, you know, they can put degenerative joint disease, they can put non-inflammatory arthropathy as the answer. Remember, what are some key things to know about osteoarthritis for your exams, right? It's going to be more common than rheumatoid arthritis, right? It's going to be more common. You're going to see it in older people. In fact, let me ask you this. What is the biggest risk factor? What is the strongest risk factor? What is the most important risk factor for osteoarthritis? It's going to be age. It's going to be what? Age. Age is the biggest risk factor in your exams for osteoarthritis. And let me ask you this. Who tends to get osteoarthritis more? Is it men or women? It's going to be women. OA is more common in women. Although, if you look at hip arthritis on the exams, whatever bizarre reason, hip arthritis is usually more common in men. Actually, in the real world, hip arthritis is also more common in men, right? And again, what are some things you're going to see in osteoarthritis? It's going to worsen with use, right? As they use that joint, it hurts more. As they rest that joint, the pain kind of goes down. And they can have stiffness on your exam. Stiffness does not always mean RA. Stiffness can also be found in OA. It's just that the stiffness in OA tends to be briefer than the stiffness in RA. It's not as long lasting. And sometimes they will even tell you that, oh, that when they use that joint in the morning, you can hear a grating sound, G-R-A-T-I-N-G, a grating sound. You hear crepitus, right? You hear crepitus. So what are you going to see on imaging? This is floridly high yield to know for your exams. You're obviously going to see asymmetric joint space narrowing. That's very, very high yield to know for your exams. In osteoarthritis or degenerative joint disease or non-inflammatory arthropathy, you're going to see asymmetric joint space narrowing. But in rheumatoid arthritis, you're going to see symmetric joint space narrowing, right? And then in osteoarthritis, you're also going to see a loss of the articular cartilage, right? So that articular cartilage is going to be lost. Say, for example, look at the knee. If you lose that articular cartilage, you're basically rubbing bone on bone. That's going to hurt. That's literally going to hurt. That's literally going to hurt, right? Because you've lost that articular cartilage. You've lost that articular cartilage, right? You're going to see osteophytes. Like literally, these things I'm saying, you should be able to identify them on imaging on your exams. You should be able to identify them on imaging on your exams. The asymmetric joint space narrowing, the loss of articular cartilage, osteophytes. Those are like bone overhangs you find around the joint. You should be able to identify those on your exams. And then you should also be able to identify a subchondral cyst. A subchondral cyst is very prototypical of osteoarthritis on the exams. Now, one weird thing that they love to do on the USMLEs is, again, to make an arrow question, right? They can ask about these weird enzymes. Because you may wonder, what in the world are they going to be testing in terms of enzyme activity with osteoarthritis? Well, let me shock you. One classic thing that they love to test is which of the following enzymes will record increased activity in a person with osteoarthritis. And they'll put a bunch of different enzymes, you know, that people are familiar with. You know, they'll say glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase, alkaline phosphatase, blah, 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 blah. They'll put a bunch of like bone-related enzymes. Here's the one you want to pick. You want to pick increased metalloproteinase activity. Wait, what? Yes. I kid you not. You may say Divine is messing around. I promise you, with this rapid review series or with any of my podcasts, I'm certainly not messing around. You're going to have increased metalloproteinase activity. You're going to have increased what? Metalloproteinase activity. It's those metalloproteinases that literally will chew up your articular cartilage. They'll literally do what? Chew up your articular cartilage. That's why you have the loss. That's why you have that loss of the articular cartilage in osteoarthritis, So again, please keep that at the back of your mind for your exams. Now, what are some classic people that they love to set up for osteoarthritis on the test? Well, the classic person is the old individual, right? Old people tend to be the ones that get osteoarthritis. But obesity is also a risk factor for osteoarthritis. I mean, think about it. If you're obese, you're going to be heavily, heavily weight-bearing. That's going to mess up your joints. That's going to raise your risk of osteoarthritis, right? And also, if a person has joint injury very early in life, So say, for example, a person has like trauma to a bone very early in life, or the person has some kind of accident that damages their joint, that's going to cause problems. Or let's say, for example, the person has one of those pediatric orthopedic disorders, right? One of those pediatric orthopedic disorders, like juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, for example, that can raise the person's risk of osteoarthritis down the line. Those people tend to have osteoarthritis a little bit earlier than the normal person, right? And again, remember, how do we treat osteoarthritis? You're usually going to start with exercises, right? Sometimes you can try to strengthen the muscles around the joint. That can help. You can just do walking. You know, just general exercise really helps. Weight loss, if you're obese, that's going to help. Usually for osteoarthritis, we try to recommend lifestyle interventions to start. But if that does not work, then you need to go for acetaminophen. Acetaminophen is the first line pharmacotherapy for osteoarthritis. If that doesn't work, you tack on an NSAID. If that doesn't work, you're going to start popping steroids into that joint. If that doesn't work, then you're going to go ahead and replace that joint. That's what you're going to do. I think this podcast is kind of, I don't want to go off on another rant with another topic. So I think I should go ahead and stop here. Again, I have a bunch of classes for the USMLEs in the month of April. For step one to step three, I have a test taking class. I have a biostats class that's 4 hours long. I have a social science and ethics healthcare systems quality improvement class that's 5 hours long. And then for step two, step three, I have a 20-hour course. And then I have a 3-hour last-minute review. It's like a very quick, high-yield review. It doesn't go into as much depth as a 20-hour class. It's not possible, right? 20 hours versus 3 hours, big difference. But again, many people, I suspect, will find the course to be extremely helpful. A lot of integrative scenarios. Again, these courses are not lectures. They're pretty much all case scenarios, like MBME style questions. And again, I try to really help you understand path office and make integrations. And then I offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and complex exams and med school exams. And then I also help with ERAS applications and personal statements and rec letters and all those things. And then I have this podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify. And again, remember, I have a YouTube channel where I post the videos that I make. And remember, you can literally just go to my website, divineinterventionpodcast.com. No logins, nothing. You can listen to and download podcasts from there for free. And then I also have another website called divineinterventionlifelessons.com. Every week from a biblical perspective, I post two podcasts. They're usually about 10 minutes long and address a life lesson. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that. Again, divineinterventionlifelessons.com. Now, the quick life lesson I want to give today is just the importance of what do you do wherever you go? What do you do wherever you go? Are you like these antigen antibody complexes that cause problems everywhere they go? Or are you the kind of person that wherever you go, you spread positivity, you spread good, right? Because you'd be amazed that people, when they show up to a place, the peace that was there is gone. You don't want to be that kind of person. Honestly, it's really hard to hang around such kind of people, really hard to have relationships with those kinds of people. So I'm just going to try to encourage you today. Be the kind of person that spreads peace. Wherever you go, spread peace, spread good. When you're leaving, let people be like, oh, really? Are you leaving this place? Right? That should be the kind of testimony you want. You don't want people to be like, whew, this person is finally gone. Thank God. No, you don't want that kind of testimony. Because you see some people, they are very ruthless. They don't care about, they're just so self-focused, so self-absorbed that they don't care what happens to others. They just care about themselves. Let me tell you this. If you're living that kind of life, your life is very, very empty. That's the truth. I don't mean to sound harsh, but that life is one of the emptiest lives there is. You don't want to have that kind of life, if I'm being perfectly honest with you, right? Just because, again, like, for example, could I just focus on my own thing? No, but I love making these podcasts. I feel like it fulfills some good in the community, some good in the medical world. And I just love doing it. Teaching is my passion. I've thought for pretty much all my life. I love teaching in church, in school, in many different settings, even at home, right? So again, I'll just encourage you, right? Like, just be the person that makes positive impact everywhere you go. Make that your goal that, oh, whenever I'm leaving a place, I'm going to leave it a lot better than I got there, right? Don't go and tear something down. No, go and build things up. Build people up, right? That's just, that nurturing characteristic is very good for a person's life. Well, I'm going to get off my soapbox now. Well, thank you for listening to me today. I'll see you in episode 528. Have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.